L'acqua va tonda la città, largo. La 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 la. No! Presto, batega, che leve già, presto. La 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 la. No!
Well, hello out there in podcast land, and welcome back to Guilty Pleasures, the show where we celebrate the movies we love despite what critics, public opinion, or even our own God-given sense might tell us. I'm your host, Lou Hare, for the Front Row Network, and welcome and happy Oscar Sunday, everyone. We're very excited to be coming to you live on the date of the Academy Awards. Not live, this is pre-recorded, but you get the idea. We're dropping this for you as a special Oscar Sunday treat. And of course, if we're going to be, it's Oscar Sunday, let's talk about Oscar. That is our movie for this episode, celebrating its 30th anniversary tomorrow, April 26th, 1991. We almost got it to the date.
Wow. Yeah, that's crazy.
That is, that was a happy accident. I cared more about the title matching up with the awards than I did about its actual date, but you know, I'll claim it as a win. So I am excited to talk about this show or this movie on the show tonight, and I'm very happy to welcome back our guests. First off, a regular to Guilty Pleasures, because if she's gonna sit through these movies, she's gonna talk about them, my lovely wife Donna Hare. How's it going, Donna?
All right, thanks.
I'm thankful. Thank you for coming back.
You're welcome.
Thank you for willingly watching these movies with me.
This one was less painful than some of the ones.
Good.
I will say that.
We're off to a good start. And joining us, it's been a minute since we've had her on, since I think our Haunted Mansion episode, but she is one of the co-hosts of Beyond the Mouse, a regular to the Front Row Network. Please welcome Vanessa Ferguson. How's it going, Vanessa?
It's going really well. I kind of forgot about that Haunted Mansion, or maybe I put it out of my memory, actually. But I'm so excited to talk about this film, because this is a film I actually really love.
Good. I'm glad. It's always nice when people are excited. Normally, like, there's at least one guest who's like, why did you make me do this? and we just kind of sit and have therapy for an hour and a half. But I think this will be fun. As happenstance, you know, we didn't pull you too far away from Disney, because this is technically a Disney release.
Oh, I was looking up info about this movie, and actually, even in the, when it just starts, it says Touchstone, and I was like, Touchstone? Yes. That is a company that was owned by Disney and made a bunch of films that people don't realize are actually Disney movies.
Yeah, it was their version of like people have Swiss bank accounts for the money they don't want to claim. Disney had Touchstone for the movies that like weren't quite family enough for the Disney banner, but they right. still wanted to make them and put them out there. So like this and Three Men and a Baby and a whole bunch of slew of films that I loved in that era. So see, again, things just have a way of working themselves out.
Yeah.
So let's get into it. Let's talk about Oscar. As we mentioned, celebrating its 30th anniversary. For those of you who have not seen it, on the day he tries to go legitimate, Angelo snaps provolone, must contend with mistaken identity, star-crossed lovers, and his past rivals. It stars Sylvester Stallone, the exact person you think of when you think of this kind of a film, but a outstanding cast. Like, I did not realize, I hadn't seen this movie. I knew about Marissa Tomei, who's also in this, and I knew about Sylvester Stallone, but man, we're gonna get into it later, but there's too many people to mention in this opening, so we'll just kind of sprinkle it in along the way, all of the great actors this movie has. It's directed by John Landis, who was kind of on the downward trend at this point in his career, but he was obviously the director behind Animal House and Coming to America and the Blues Brothers. So really at the time, Stallone's one of the biggest stars in Hollywood. He's one of the biggest directors in comedy. What could go wrong? Well, a couple of things. It turns out that people were not necessarily ready for a 1930s style screwball comedy based on a French play starring Sylvester Stallone. Who knew? It grosses $23 million off of a $35 million budget.
Ouch.
Yeah, real bad. This is, I believe, one of Stallone's worst performing movies of all time. Yeah, and its current Rotten Tomato score is a robust 12%. Its IMDb score slightly higher than you would think, 6.6, which I think bears out the theory. If people had actually seen the movie, they might have liked it. But nobody saw this movie in 1991, and this was a kind of a beginning of a downturn in the career of Sylvester Stallone. But I want to start with you, Vanessa, and get your first impressions, because you told me something in the chat the other day that blew my mind about this movie and Sylvester Stallone.
Well, so I believe it came out in 1991. And yes. I was a wee lass then. And at the time, my family, we didn't go to the movies a ton. So I believe we bought this on VHS, probably because of Sylvester Stallone, who I've always known as the leading man of this movie. I, for a long time, didn't know that he was in any other films. I've never seen Rambo. I've seen clips of it. And the one, isn't he in the one where he's hanging off a cliff? Cliffhanger? Yes. Yeah, that's another way of titling it. The one where he's hanging off the cliff.
And you're like, that snaps Provolone.
I seriously was like, that's the guy from that hilarious movie. A lot of the jokes obviously went over my head as a kid, but I remember my family loved it. I thought it was really funny. I loved Marissa Tomei, Dr. Poole, Tim Curry. So my first impression was, this is a hilarious movie. And I was shocked the other day to hear you say this is going to be on your show. And I thought, no. People love this movie. This is a well-loved comedy. And imagine my surprise when I pull up Rotten Tomatoes and I'm like, what is happening? But in my defense, you sent me the link to the YouTube video, which you can watch. And in the comment section, it is filled with people going, I don't know why people hate this movie. It's a really good movie. So there are people like me out there.
Great. And that's, I'm so glad to have you on to stump for this movie, because I think that's one of the fun things we do is get to revisit movies that were kind of reviled in their time, or maybe even just misunderstood. Because I love the fact, by the way, that in your life history, Sylvester Stallone was a comedic actor who turned to action as opposed to an action star trying to branch out, which is how the rest of the world saw this movie.
Yeah, I mean, it makes total sense.
Saw him in Rhinestones. So I think that's my first impression of Stallone.
So you saw him as a musical star. That's even wilder. I love that.
Donna, yeah. I'm sorry, I haven't seen that movie either. I think I told Lou that this might be the only movie I've seen with Sylvester Stallone fully. I mean, just from start to finish, I think this is the only movie I've seen with him in it.
Rhinestone is a trip, and you can find our episode on that in the archive section. We cover that. We've hit a lot of Stallone. I love Stallone.
Tango and Cash.
We've talked about Tango and Cash. So the funny thing is, as I was prepping for this, this is a very specific time in Stallone's career, because the 80s were filled with just wall-to-wall action. That's his bread and butter. Rocky, Rambo, Cobra. Tango and Cash comes out at the end of the 80s, and it was like already like this weird hybrid action comedy, which I love. But you could tell he was like trying to show his range. This is the movie that, then he goes back, he does Rocky V, everybody hates it. Then he does this movie, and then he does Stop or My Mom Will Shoot. And the back-to-back flops that were Oscar and Stop or My Mom Will Shoot is what made him go, maybe I should go back to doing action. And he goes back and he does Cliffhanger, and all is right with the world. I'll point out, we've done Tango and Cash, Rocky V, and now Oscar. So I guess we have to like round out that by doing Stop or My Mom Will Shoot at some point. But that's that's something for another day. So Donna, I want to ask you your first impressions of this movie, because I had never seen this movie until the podcast, but you had a vague familiarity with the movie.
Yeah, for some reason I feel like I have seen this movie, but all I could remember was Stallone in a suit in a backyard. So that's my recollection of Oscar. So when we were watching, I thought his name was going to be Oscar for some reason.
I did too.
So it was a surprise. So maybe I haven't really seen this movie. Maybe I'm remembering Stop or My Mom Will Shoot. That's what I was just trying to look on my phone right now. It's like, let's get some images of that on here. Maybe that's what I'm remembering.
Maybe you just fell asleep during the patio scene. Because, you know, that scene goes on for a minute. We'll say that. But yeah. Okay. Let's get into it. And I'll open it up to Vanessa. So yeah. So just also, we dabbled on this a little bit. Yeah. This is a movie that is based on a French play. It was made.
And it so feels it. Like I could almost feel the set change happening each time. And it's like, oh wow, we really have got the set change music now. Like it's just, it felt. I wonder how true to form this is to that play.
I would imagine, because there are moments where Stallone is literally just walking from room to room to do the next scene. And it's with a different character. I'm in this room talking to this one. Now I'm in this room talking to this person. Like,
well, it felt very noises off as well.
Very noises off. Yeah. The patter is what really, there's a lot of, and there's also a lot of exposition. Especially they do that thing where play adaptations, like give you that exposition in the first scene. But in the film adaptation, there's always that first scene that explains it that then makes the exposition like superfluous. And they do that in this one where the first scene I have to imagine was written for the movie because it was just a way to get Kirk Douglas to show up.
Which is amazing, can I just say.
Like, I want to know the thought process that went saying, you know who should play Sylvester Stallone's dad? Kirk Douglas.
I don't know. But I think he, again, I think he does it so well. It's so funny the way he's just smacking him back. I mean, I think if you have to pick someone older to smack around Sylvester Stallone, it can't be anybody feeble. It's got to be him. It's got to be Kirk Douglas because he's that strong leading man actor from way back when, I guess not that long ago, but from the classic movies that we know.
It also blows my mind because Kirk Douglas just passed away last year and he lived to 103. So he was like 73 in this movie.
And here I'm thinking, oh, he wasn't that old in that movie, but he really was older. Just, he could have been his father.
He just had a real long run. Wow. I mean, he just, it's, and that's like, it kind of, there's a lot of things with age in this movie that we're going to dial back to every once in a while. But yeah, that was the first, but no, that's a good point. But it's hilarious because he also sets the tone for the comic energy of the movie because he is milking the one scene he has.
Oh my goodness.
That's a good way to put it.
He's like
that accent.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
That real thick fake accent. Italian accent. That's the so you don't forget. That's usable in daily life.
Once once again, when you need someone to play an aging Italian patriarch,
who called else do you think
Kirk
of?
Kirk Douglas. Yeah. No, yeah, he's got the, like, his face when he's, like, he's just mugging up a storm, and it's like, okay, this is the energy we're bringing to this, and I was like, okay, I see you, Oscar, I'm ready for this.
I felt like we were playing for a full house when we weren't a full house, like, we're all just arena style on top of it, and he's playing way out to the back of the theater, and it's like, okay, we see you there.
Yeah.
That's a perfect way to describe it. I love your guys' take on this, because yes to all of it.
Yeah, well, and he's not alone, because we're gonna get into it. I'll ask you later, we're gonna talk about some of those other performances, but yeah, so so this is a basic, if you're not familiar with this style of comedy, it's a basic farce where everybody mixes up everybody's names, the stories are twisted, identities are reversed, and then everything like magically makes sense to each other once all the characters get into the same room together. Like, that's basically every farce you've ever seen. And so that, like,
and a lot of running around
and
a lot of running up and down stairs.
Yep, Stallone was getting that cardio in still.
Yeah, he was doing good.
Which is great, because it's like, because, you know, he's Rocky and he's got the famous running up the stairs, but it's like, hey, you know what's funny? If we just make him do that for 90 minutes.
True. Yeah.
So let's start with Stallone here, because again, this was a big shift for him. He had done Rhinestone previously. It did not go well. So this is basically his second attempt at a comedy. And he has to be the center of this movie. And I'll be honest, if you've never seen Rhinestone, he is a Muppet in that movie. He's a glorified Muppet. He is like, he's got flop sweat. He is flinging himself all over the place in this. So I was kind of expecting that energy. I was really surprised at how good he was in this movie. I actually thought, you know, this is the right kind of wheelhouse. What did you think, Vanessa?
Well, so looking back, watching it now as an adult, I realized that I missed a lot of the dialogue by his accent. I don't know if that's his real accent or if it was his fake Italian broken English accent. I'm still confused about what's going on there.
That's pure uncut Stallone.
That's just what he sounds like.
Accents have never been his bag.
Okay, because there's a line where he says, "I never learned to talk good." And I was like, okay, is this an acting choice? But I always thought it was Stallone, but I didn't know with the way the dialogue was. So I thought he did a great job, except looking back, I don't always understand what he is saying. So which again, the comment section on YouTube really helped me, because people are throwing out their favorite lines. I'm like, oh, disarming Germany, that's what he says. Oh, you know, lunch yet. Oh, I never heard lunch yet when he's telling Marissa Tomei's character that she has to stay with this fiance. I never heard that line correctly. So if I had to knock him down a few points, it'll be for his diction. But other than that, I like him. I think he's convincing. He's handsome. He looks kind of Italian. I'm assuming he's Italian, Stallone. Yes. It all made sense for me. He looks like a mob boss. It worked for me.
Yeah, it is funny now that you say that in this movie that's so dialogue driven and also really fast paced, the person you get to deliver a lot of fast-paced dialogue is Sylvester Stallone.
Yeah.
Which, by the time he hits Rocky IV, he has, like, 12 lines in the whole movie. Like, he's not known for his...
And then they have him learning words of the day.
Yeah. Which, by the way, that expeditiously...
Expeditiously, that's it.
I know that word only because of this movie, by the way. And also that opening song... The Barber of Seville. Opera houses everywhere will be upset to know that was my first experience with opera. I thought that song came from that movie. It wasn't until years later I realized it was from an opera. My dog's name is Figaro. I named him after that song. So obviously it was very impactful on me as a little one.
My order goes differently. I think I got it first from Bugs Bunny. Then Mrs. Doubtfire, and now Oscar. So, from the actual opera.
Still trying to figure out why claymation, why all of that.
Yeah, and that's also something I was looking back. I'm like, I'm a little confused because I remember thinking this was a kid's movie, and it's not because there's lots of guns. Yeah. But it just never clicked with me that it wasn't anything. I mean, it had claymation.
Well, that's PG. So, I mean, it was a kid's movie.
Fair.
Yeah. I mean, it's clean. I mean, it's the comedy's never, I mean, it's not dirty comedy at all. It's mm-hmm. It's very, especially by today's standard, it's really family friendly. Mm-hmm. Like you could put it on Disney Plus and not bat an eye at it. Cause that's the thing. Like there's gangsters, but they're not like gangsters.
Right.
Like,
they're threatening you with a chicken thigh.
They're like gangsters.
A chicken quarter.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Everyone here is so broad. I don't think you'd have an issue here. But yeah, it's the time frame where I'm so glad movies evolve. I'm so glad we got past the 5 to 10 minute opening credit scene.
Oh, that was forever.
I was like, yeah, all like just this little claymation figure comes out and sings Figaro while the credits roll. the opening credits, and it has nothing to do with anything. It's literally like a pizza mascot kind of looking guy.
Someone worked for weeks on that, like maybe even months, for that opening credits that had nothing to do with the movie.
No.
No, well, I guess that's true. I never thought of it that way.
You got to get that runtime up. That's the other thing. Like, I think there was a rule in like the early 90s where movies had to hit like an hour 45 to be considered like a serious movie. Because anything, so like there's some padding that happens there. And
a lot of padding. We could have cut out a lot. There are a lot of things, a lot of dead space that we could have trimmed.
Yeah. So we meet Stallone, and he's going legitimate because of that opening scene. Kirk Douglas on his deathbed gets him to promise. And so that's like the backdrop for all of this different things going on. So I guess to go into the story or the scenes, let's use the performances as a way to get there, because one of the things that we learn is that he believes his daughter wants to get married, and his daughter is played by Marissa Tomei, who is, I believe this is her first major acting role, which is crazy because like a year later she does My Cousin Vinny and then wins an Oscar. Like that's like, that happens super fast. But she's another one who is just swinging for the fences in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Especially those temper tantrums that she throws. It's like, I know she's doing it to be excessive because she's putting on an act, but it was like, whew. Again, we're theater in the round here. It's small theater. This is not your grand old proscenium arch theater here. Like, we're all with you. Yeah. Right here.
I always kind of, I don't know. I love that because I you're right. When I see it as a play, and so as I'm watching this, I'm like, oh, I just see this. It's almost as if they recorded a stage performance, and which I love. It's but it's shot like a film, but it is a stage performance. So I love Marissa Tomei in this movie. The only thing that kind of confused me was I always thought she was a lot older than what she was playing. And the whole, I'm a woman, look at me, daddy. And I was like, oh my God, what is this?
And but, especially when you learn later, she's 17.
Yeah,
she was 17 in this movie. Older.
No, her character is
17. Oh yeah, her character, yeah.
It's like, yeah. Caught things on the second watch that I was like, oh, okay, all right. Well, different time, okay.
Yeah, and so, because growing up, I always thought she was an older person. I didn't think she was a teenager when I watched this, so it didn't strike me as weird until as I watched as an adult. And she's even kind of flirty with Stallone in a couple of those moments. And I'm like, oh, this is odd, but yeah. I'll just pretend that she's not his real daughter. She would have
been 27 in this movie.
Yep.
That's why she doesn't look 17.
No, she's, yeah. Yes. It does make the relationship that happens between her and Tim Curry more palatable because she looks, at least looks older, and he definitely he's about 20 years older than she is in real life. So
that worked.
So that worked because yeah, if she looks like she's 17, that's even way more. Yeah. And yes, there are things in my life I didn't know that I needed that Oscar gave me. And one of them is Marissa Tomei and Tim Curry as a couple.
Yeah, it's not that believable for me, but that's okay.
No, it's not believable at all.
Yeah,
in the slightest. But they're both wonderful creatures and deserve happiness, so I'm fine with it. Yeah.
It's a really interesting pairing. It makes for really fun scenes between them, especially out in the atrium. As Stallone calls it. So, yeah, and I love Dr. Poole anyway. I just think he's hilarious. So, a good matching for comedy's sake.
Yeah, he does. He shows up about halfway through the movie. He is snaps his elocution, like his instructor. Yeah, he's what is he like? My Fair Lady. Snaps.
Very Henry Higgins.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. He's the Henry Higgins to Stallone's Eliza Doolittle.
Yes.
Does that work? Okay. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Which, so yeah, and he's there and he gets roped into this because it's all about Snaps' character and his accountant. The accountant is in love with, Stallone, a girl that he thinks is Stallone's daughter, but it's not. So there leads that all confusion, but ultimately Snaps falls in love with, Snaps sets his daughter up with.
Snaps that she's pregnant because she wants to get out of the house. Cause he goes up and says, I know that you're going to get married. And she's like, oh, he asked you. And it was turns out Oscar's the chauffeur, but he's gone away. And so he thinks the accountant's going to marry her, but she doesn't. So then he has to find a new husband, and that's where Tim Curry comes in.
Yes. And then they...
To find the father for this fake unborn child.
Yes. And then they fall in love for real.
For realsies.
For realsies. And it's such a... And Curry is so... He is just another all-star ham bone in this movie.
He's so thirsty in this movie. Like, you can just see it in his eyes. He's just so thirsty.
Yeah. Go ahead, Vanessa.
I love it. My favorite Tim Curry moment in this whole film is one word when he leans over the balcony and says, hello.
That's where he looks as thirsty as he's like, yes.
He just so desperately wants to be a part of the action. Whatever it is, it's like, oh. And his backstory is like he's with his mom, and his mom has like is gallbladder issues, and so he's basically like his one time out of the house is teaching Snaps how to speak. But then he gets to like he's very excited because he gets to go to Appalachia and
study dialects,
study the dialects of the coal miners, and so he's a world traveler by Marissa Tomei's purview. So,
and that's all she wants in life is to travel.
Yeah, that's all she wanted. But yeah, so that's one thing that's going on. And then the other thing that's going on is this kind of exchange between the exchange of money, or who's gonna marry whom, between Snaps and his accountant, who's played by Vincent Spano, who I looked him over, he had kind of a moment in the early 90s as kind of maybe the next possible like leading man, and it never quite panned out. But his character is Anthony Rossano, and he has fallen in love with a girl who has lied to him about being Snaps' daughter. And so there's this exchange, and this is where the comedy of errors comes in, of an exchange of money to like buy off Anthony so that he can have money to marry Snaps' daughter, but Snaps wants to get his money back. What do we think of Vincent Spano? Because he's maybe one of the lesser known actors in the film, Vanessa.
I liked him in this movie. It's funny to me because I know this is going to sound strange, and you guys, I just already can gauge your reaction, but to me he sounded like Billy Crystal, who I love. Just some of the way he was talking, like when he says, yes, she deserves a husband that makes $14,000. Like, I could hear Billy Crystal delivering those lines. They don't look anything alike, and Billy Crystal's far more successful. But I liked him in this movie. I did look him up and saw that there really wasn't going much, or there wasn't much I don't know, more success for him in the film industry. I didn't recognize any of the films or projects that he's worked on since, which is kind of a shame because I thought he did a good job. But I could see how some of the plot does get a bit confusing, especially when he knows that Stallone has two daughters, Snaps has two daughters, and yet he signs a paper saying that he's going to give money, marry this a daughter, and it's not specified in the contract.
That he has two daughters.
Well, when they're walking into the scene to the library where they sign the paper, as they're walking, he says, I didn't know you had two daughters. And Stallone says, oh yeah, the house is full of surprises this morning. And so that's the quick dialogue that I was like, huh, I wonder why they included that, because he's going to go sign a paper, or he's in the next few scenes with Stallone, he's going to sign a paper that says that kind of messes him up, that locks him into marrying the real daughter. And so that I was like, oh, I wish they would have taken that out. Oh, by the way, I watched this like maybe 5 times since you told me that we were.
Wow.
So I'm like, so I love this movie so much. So I was a little more honed in on a few things that I thought were like, oh, that's what, because honestly, I'm trying to find things not to like about this movie just so I can stay on par with everybody else, because I personally love it, but.
That is fine. No, absolutely. So that is the crux of the plot. Let's get into some performers here, because this is a really big ensemble. So there are, just to give you these, I'll read some names, and some of you will know who I'm talking about, but most of you won't unless you see the people, but you absolutely know who these people are. So we talked about Stallone, we talked about Marissa Tomei, but we also have Chaz Palminteri's in this movie. Don Ameche shows up, Eddie Brackett, Art LaFleur, Kurtwood Smith, Harry Shearer, William Atherton, Mark Metcalf. We talked about Tim Curry. And then in the very end, Dallas's own Linda Gray shows up. It's just like a plethora, and on top of Stallone and Kirk Douglas. And like, it is like a incredibly deep roster of actors that all committed to this movie. And all of them bring very different energies to the film. So let's talk about some of these individual performances from the secondary characters, because everybody just kind of comes in and out, and Snaps really is like the center of the story. Donna, I'll start with you. If you had to give an award for the biggest ham of the movie, who gets the Oscar for biggest ham?
Oh, it's got to be the guy that has to watch the bag and the daughter. What's his name?
That would be...
Is that Chaz?
That would be Chaz Palminteri, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm glad you brought him up, because, first of all, yeah, it's so startling to see him in this movie, because his career is mostly, like, tough guy roles.
Mm-hmm. And well, so it's a natural fit. He's a gangster, right? He looks the part.
Yeah, it is. But I said... You know, the Curry and Marissa Tomei thing was something I didn't know I needed. Another thing I didn't know I needed in my life was Sylvester Stallone and Chaz Palminteri doing an Abbott and Costello routine. They have an exchange over the bag, because he's trying to, and it's the moment where you're like trying to figure, it's the moment where the plot of the movie is explained for all of us who have gotten completely confused. And it's done in this like exchange. It's fantastic. But yeah, he also has this moment where it's the one weird moment of the movie, because it's like a very Naked Gun type moment where he has to like pull, like Stallone wants to be legit, so he doesn't want his guys to have guns. And he goes to Chaz, and Chaz just keeps pulling weapon
all
after weapon.
All of these weapons. That was one of the things that I was like, we could tighten this up, right? Like, come on.
Oh my gosh. I had to say, I love that scene. I'm like, what weapon are they going to pull out next? And it's just, I'm like, they can't have any more. Where is he hiding them? And then he just keeps pulling them out of his vest and his sock. And the last one before the last tiny gun in the sock is some dynamite, which is ticking. I'm like, that doesn't sound like a very good idea. But that scene always made me laugh a lot.
The mace,
it's so ridiculous.
The mace is what gets me.
Yeah, it's like, how is he keeping that under his coat? That's prickly.
Yeah. No, it's a fun bit. It's a weird bit for this movie, because it's the only like slapsticky move. Like,
it had just been shortened a bit. It was very Naked Gunny.
Yes.
But the rest of the movie isn't Naked Gunny. So, yeah.
That's true.
If it could have just been shortened a bit.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Nope. That's an excellent choice. Vanessa, who gets your Oscar for hammiest performance?
Hammiest? Well, I mean, this is not my favorite character, but a big ham for me is the Lieutenant Toomey. He's
yes.
He's from what show is he from? That's 70s
show? 70s show.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's wild. Kurtwood Smith is his name, but you know, he's very cheesy. I love though at the end when he's like, this doesn't make any sense. I got it. The bag. It's just, it's so just like a line from a play. Like it just make it very simple for the audience to understand what's going on. Just hand it to them. And then it sets up for a nice joke at the end.
And I think doesn't he even look directly in the camera at that moment too?
I don't remember if he does or not. The only one that I specifically remember looking at the camera is Sylvester Stallone in the opening with Kirk Douglas. Mm-hmm. Yeah, as he deadpans the camera, which was very funny to me.
I think it happens a couple of times because almost every John Landis movie has a character like will look into the camera at least once. Like I know it happens in Animal House, it happens in Coming to America. I'm almost positive it happens in Blues Brothers. So like I'm sure that's like a very much a John Landis thing. So I'm almost positive that happens. Okay, so I know we mentioned a lot of famous actors, but I'm gonna give my Oscar, my Hammy, to Jocelyn O'Brien. Jocelyn O'Brien is was a television actress, not a whole lot of credits. She plays Nora, the Irish maid. And if I didn't know she was actually Irish, I would have found this performance incredibly offensive.
Is that her true accent?
I can't believe that's her true accent.
I don't think it is.
But she is of Irish descent, and maybe she has some accent that she's just dialing up to 11 for this.
Maybe.
But oh my gosh. Like her and Marissa had like this energy of, I'm in a big time movie. I am in with some big stars and a big director. I am going to put every ounce of energy I have into this movie because this
Meanwhile, I feel like the director is like, bring it up a little more. Okay, now take it a little bit farther for this next shot. And they're like, all right, I'll just give you whatever comes out so you'll stop making me do this. And that's like how we get most of Marissa Tomei's performance in this. It's just, all right, let's just take one more. Just go crazy with this one. And that's the shot they used.
That is fair. That is fair. I think that's a fair assumption. As far as Nora the maid goes, she's funny to me. But I can see what you're saying, that a lot of her scenes are that, I mean, all the accents in this film are pretty over the top, especially her Irish accent of, what did she say? I'll be having servants of me own. You know, it's just, it's just like, okay. I don't know and that I they love talk how like
she,
that.
Her bag that she leaves, the only bag she came with was just filled with underwear.
Underwear.
Right. Yeah.
She had no other clothes, like no other belongings, no other possessions, just some underwear.
She had one outfit. She has her maid's outfit and her underwear. That's it.
And a lot of underwear.
A lot of underwear.
Which is also one of my favorite Tim Curry moments of the movie. Because
he's like, and here's the money.
Stallone thinks he's paying off Tim Curry and dumps the bag, but the underwear comes out instead of what's supposed to be money because that's part of the farce thing. And Tim Curry just decides he's going to go. His character decides he's going to go along and is really condescending. Oh, look, he picks up a bra and acts like it's a $20 bill. I was like, oh, like, I feel like I know so much about that one character. Like, that's how good Tim Curry is. Like, I just, you can see like the thought process of that character in just what's a, like a dumb comedy bit, but it's so good. But yeah, she's, you mentioned the accents, Vanessa. Let's get to it. Everybody in this movie.
Except one. And I just looked her up and she's actually an Italian actress because when she opened her mouth, I'm like, talk more, because she wasn't crazy. Now she's mad 100% of the time, but Sophia Provolone, the mom,
yes,
has a lovely accent.
Yes.
And she's beautiful. And like the dresses she wears, this is a very beautiful movie. Just the set pieces, the costuming, the cars, everything is beautiful. Mm-hmm. And she just stood out to me as a refreshing. And then she was just screaming the whole time. And I was like, oh, okay, well.
Yeah. No, yeah, she's the one like authentic Italian that they that
how
they
insulting has. Must she have felt to walk onto there and have everyone doing these horrible mockery of the Italian dialect speaking English.
I think at that point
she's just happy to be there. She's like, I look good. So
she
looks amazing. I want all of that.
I mean, in all fairness, what you're saying, Donna, the Fenucci brothers, who neither of those guys are Italian. They're American actors. One has gone on to do voices for The Simpsons. The other one was in Jurassic Park, mm-hmm. and they use the word the milk a manna in front of her, and I'm like, oh, ouch! That's gotta sting her ears to hear. But I do love the Fenucci brothers in this movie.
They are so good. They have, those are characters, like, if they were on SNL, I'd want them to be recurring characters.
Yes.
I would see them. I would watch a Fenucci Brothers skit every, couple of weeks.
I do love the fact that they bring out a clipping of a man shot over a dinner table as, like, their finest piece of work. Mm-hmm. And then the payoff is lovely when, at the end, he shows, is it the accountant or Tim Curry that he shows the picture to?
Anthony. And
the accountant. Yeah.
And that he thinks he's showing him like they're murderers. Mm-hmm. So that paid off. I was like, why is that the picture that they show? But then it pays off.
Right. No, they are so. And you mentioned Harry Shearer is who if you from Spinal Tap, and like he was on SNL for a hot minute, but now he's voices half of the Simpsons characters and just a fantastic comedic voice. He's delightful in it, and there's such this great little pairing. And I think maybe that's the secret of why maybe Stallone is also as good in this movie as he is, because he doesn't have to try a whole lot. He just has to be like the center. Like he's
the straight man.
He's the straight man for all of this, and he reacts to everything, and then everybody around him is just bonkers. Yeah.
Because he does look a lot more comfortable in this than in Rhinestone.
100%. Yes.
He looks confident, like he knows what he's doing. It's not weird.
Yep. Nope. This is definitely, if you have to watch one comedic vehicle for Sylvester Stallone, it's this one.
And can I also add about the Fenucci brothers? We get that really hilarious piano scene between them and the accountant, which again was a little weird because the accountant has just found out that he is locked into this marriage with this daughter that he doesn't like. And then he goes and plays a happy little jazz song.
Well, and let's play the piano. Yeah. And then we hear all these other sounds coming off the piano. And only after they've played the full song does he realize that they have joined in and started playing the piano with him.
Right. It's a good bit. It's such a fun. And that's, again, how you know this is, again, has its roots in the theater.
That's very.
Because it has like all these just little bits. Mm-hmm. that come in that they're like, hey, let's do this for a little bit. And it's like, because film bits and theater bits are different. Mm-hmm. Like a film bit is shorter, right? Because like you hit the laugh and then you go. But like in theater, you have to, like, the bit has to last longer for the audience to kind of recognize it, and then the laugh swells and then it dies down.
Yes.
And maybe that's like that whole bit with the Chaz Palminteri thing.
The mom
thing.
Has to come back in a different costume. So that's really covering a costume change, because she comes back in the red dress. So that's really the purpose of that.
I think we've cracked this. I think they just... I think
they straight up...
I think they recorded... This was like they grease-lived this. They just did this whole thing in one take. That would be fantastic. Sadly, I know that they did not do this in one take, because a bit of info about this before we, just a quick segue. So this movie, this was a Disney movie. It's the first movie to be shot on the MGM Disney Studios in Orlando. But one night after filming wrapped, I guess this, so maybe they did do this. After the filming wrapped, a fire destroyed a lot of the sets and a lot of the trailers and the costumes and the cars.
What a waste.
And so the production was halted for 2 weeks, until, so they had to remake all of those costumes.
Wait, but after filming Wrap, I guess, why were they?
After filming Wrap for the day, I guess, I should have worded that, because okay. My own copy got in my way there. That they, after filming Wrap for the day, there was this massive fire and a lot of things had to be rebuilt. Mm. And I think I know at least one set piece, because as much as the set pieces are great, there's one set piece that really, that felt out of place.
Is it his office?
Yeah.
With the neon, like purple. It's like, where is this coming from? Yep. Is he supposed to maybe have like painted windows or something?
Is that what that is? Okay. Yeah. No, it is that office, because when they go in, his office has weird neon pink lights, which I didn't think was a thing in the 30s.
No.
But looked very much like the back of a club.
I didn't notice that. I did notice there was some stained glass, so I will look at that.
Yes, I think it's supposed to be stained glass with the light shining through it to make it pink like that. But it doesn't match the rest of the house, because it's very white and like
clean. Did they have vacuum cleaners back then at that time? Or is that just for like the most wealthy? That's something that stood out to me.
That's another thing. Yeah, I was taken aback by that. And then, and that's the thing, I went with it in the moment because I had no idea what I was getting into when I watched this movie. I had only heard that Oscar was just a notorious bomb, and it was a Stallone comedy. So I was really cold. And so I was like, oh, maybe this is going to be like a Naked Gun where it's like anachronistic and lots of different weird kind of sight gags. No, maybe that's a thing. I don't know. Yeah.
Oh, well, I look here, it says 1901, so I guess.
Yeah, I was just looking that up as well.
Okay.
I learned something. There's so much education in this film, really, that we need to be aware of.
It's clearly really, they were really sticking to the period.
Yeah. It's really a window into the life of the Italian American experience in the 1930s, if we think about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, and I also like, we're talking about accents. If the actor doesn't have to do like a broad Italian accent, don't worry, they're all still gonna talk like they're from a 1930s radio play, because everyone's like, "Ha, see, yeah," and even like Peter Riegert's character literally turns around and goes, "Why I oughta,"
like, yeah. But he does say, what's that line that he says? Is, "You got a meeting with the Fanucci brothers at 9:30. That's so funny. I mean, come on, that's hilarious.
Yeah.
I do have one question. We've got the German driver, and they make a remark that seems very closely to like Hitler.
He calls him the Kaiser, which assumed was a World War I reference, but it does seem a lot like, I associate with World War II, but I know that hasn't happened yet.
Right,
so.
Right. Because it's like, it seems very World War II-ish, especially the way the guy was dressed and the thick German accent. Mm-hmm. And
the title character, Oscar, is off fighting in the war at the time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Yeah, well, he's not in a war. He's in a boot camp.
Boot camp. Okay, so he didn't
have enlisted.
He did enlist. Okay. Yeah, I'm gonna give this movie a little bit of a pass for its historical accuracies. And that's the funny thing is, again, you think the movie's gonna be, the character of Oscar is only mentioned like three times. He shows up at the very end. He's in for like 2 seconds. So it's a very, again, I don't know what you would call this movie aside from Oscar. But that was, again, the thing where it's like, is
snaps.
I don't know if people, okay. I know people might have been cold on a movie called Oscar starring Sylvester Stallone. I'm definitely sure they would be cold on a movie called Snaps starring Sylvester Stallone. This movie doesn't even hit 23 million if it's called Snaps.
But why Oscar? Why does that make the difference?
It's at least sounds better.
I think it's because, just from like a play standpoint, it's the last big laugh you get of the whole play before it closes. So before, and I'm very much thinking this is before the curtains are drawn, not before. It's different because this is a film and we have the funny credits where they're all kind of making silly faces at the camera. Mm-hmm. But that's, I think, why it gets its name, is just, oh, that's the last laugh of the play/movie. Which I do remember when we first saw it, we're like, that's Oscar. Like that made us, that was a big laugh for us in our house. It's like, oh, finally we get to see who this guy is who kind of starts the whole thing off. But
I could see that. And to be fair, Oscar was the name of the original play that this is based on and the film. So they probably were like, apparently this play was very popular. I do think if you translated this to English, I bet it would probably,
over every high school.
Yeah. Oh,
every high school drama department.
Yep. Yep. Because it's like 80% men and there's like four women roles.
And you can just see the sets being raised and lowered by the fly system. Everything's painted on a drop.
And the accents would be about as accurate.
Oh yes. Oh yes.
Yeah.
I could see like, 17-year-old with the unlit cigars in their mouth.
That bothered me greatly. That unlit cigar that he was running around with that entire time. That is disgusting. It had to be this soggy, nasty wad.
I said that just to trigger you because I knew that bugged you when we watched the movie.
That worked. That upset me so.
But it's a fun bit. I mean, the guy on the A-team never lit his cigar. But he would walk around with it on.
But it's okay if it's like an actual lit cigar. But he's just walking around with this chewed up, gnarled of an already smoked cigar. Like, that's disgusting.
This is all new to me. I don't know anything about cigar culture. I just, see it in like those early cartoons that you watch on Saturday mornings back in the day when they let you watch cartoons on Saturday mornings.
The other actor that I want to bring up that we haven't talked about because he's barely in the film, but man, he maximizes his minutes is Eddie Bracken as Five Spot Charlie. Most people, this by the way, has two cast members from Home Alone 2, Tim Curry and Eddie Bracken. And Eddie Bracken is the stoolie for the villainous gangsters, the Vendetti family, which by the way, like again, very like Vendetti and Provolone are the names of the warring families here. But
so is Eddie Bracken Home Alone 2?
Yes.
Is he the toy owner?
He's the toy shop owner. Yes.
I thought he looked so familiar and I was like, why does he look familiar?
Like, that's the thing. You have to have IMDb up while you watch this movie. You like, okay, I know that person. Where do I know? Oh, I know him from that. I know him. Okay, there we go. And then you can like let your brain. And then by then you've missed like five plot points.
Mm-hmm. I'm also trying to find the manicurist for Vendetti. Because I believe she's the voice of Harley Quinn in the Batman series, but I don't know her name.
She is Arlene Sorkin is her name. And I only know her as the original host of America's Funniest People with Dave Coulier that followed America's Funniest, tried to capitalize off the fame of America's Funniest Home Videos to lesser effect.
That's why she looked familiar.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. For some reason, she really bugged my mother. Like I just remember her watching the show. It's like, that show's fine, but that woman just bugs me. I don't know why. I'm like, okay, mom. I'll call ABC. I'm 12. Eddie Bracken decides his character's gonna have like this kind of comical stutter.
And does he decide that, or is that part of the play? I would imagine that's part of the play.
I don't know.
It seems like that's part of the play. Like, it is so much in there.
It's so broad that I'm assuming everybody got to do whatever they wanted in this movie. I'm giving every comedic choice I'm giving to the actors because I'm just like, because there's so much. But speaking of the Vendetti family, Richard Ramanis plays the head of the Vendettis, and he is about to leave before he goes to put his hit on Snaps. He says, order out for pizza. We'll be back in an hour.
Yeah, I never got that.
You didn't because you don't know your 1990s commercials because he actually played the Godfather for Godfather's Pizza.
Oh, wow.
That is a reference. That's a Godfather's Pizza reference.
Well, they look so pleased when they said it. Like, he said it and he sat down and smiled to himself, yep. Like all happy and proud. Yep. And then they drive over a river and it's like, where is all this water coming from?
Yep.
I got distracted.
Yeah. Nope. That's a gun. They're like, hey, yeah, we know y'all wreck. And they put him in a suit that's exactly like what the Godfather.
How did that not infringe copyrights?
I don't know if that's the exact line. I don't think that's like the tagline for Godfather.
It's the same actor in the same outfit saying something very similar. Like that had to have been too close.
John Wayne got to do that for 30 years. I think we're fine. I think Oscar could be. I don't think they weren't coming for Oscar's negative $10 million in profits. All right.
Maybe they did, and that's what happened to Godfather's Pizza. Yeah.
Okay. Any other characters that we haven't talked about yet that we want to make sure we mention?
I just really, again, like Peter Reigert as Aldo. If he's kind of the linchpin for the whole thing for me. If it weren't for his over the top, almost Boston sounding accent, his gangster accent, I don't know that the film would be quite as funny and campy for me if it weren't for him. And which isn't fair because there's a lot of characters like that, like I mentioned, the Finucci brothers, but the campiness that they play out, I think reminds you, this is just a silly comedy. This isn't to be taken seriously. I really love them.
Yeah, no, and exactly. And, you know, and especially to do all that work with a cigar in his mouth the whole time.
Right, right.
You know, which again, sorry.
I hated that.
Yeah, the one, I guess last group of people we haven't talked about because they don't do a whole lot, but they are the bankers that Stallone is trying to go legitimate with. Again, another cavalcade of character actors. So the most familiar of which is William Atherton, who everybody knows is the guy from Ghostbusters.
Okay.
So, the bad news reporter from Die Hard. But anyway, he's like they're there, and they're like the only real comment that I had on that is the lead guy, the lead banker, is this weird combination. We were talking about it. A weird. It's like Tim Gunn mm-hmm. and Dick Cheney had a baby.
Because mm-hmm. he's very Tim Gunn before Tim Gunn.
Yes.
Like, did Tim Gunn like watch this movie and that became his essence? It's like, I will be this man.
I definitely see the baby, then yeah, him as a baby for sure. Mm-hmm. This is kind of the one part of the movie where I felt it was less campy. I felt like some of the bankers are trying to play it like they were real bankers, although their lines, you know, didn't allow them to do that because some of the lines are a little still campy. But I'm relieved that they have such a short role in this film because it doesn't quite fit for the rest of it for me.
No, yeah, they're these stuffy characters and they don't really ever get to do anything that's that funny or have a lot of funny things happen to them. Mm-mm. Like they just kind of
they're just there to progress the plot.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, and then the big reveal is Snaps thinks he has a deal with them and that's going to be what helps him go legitimate. He's going to become a partner in the bank, but then he realizes that they're trying to sneak some clauses into this contract that are basically going to take it away all of his power and they just want him for his money. And so at the end of the movie, he's like, whoops, I tried, which again, very like, very tagline to the end. That's where the play ends. I don't know if the wedding happens in the play, but that whole whoops, sorry, Pop, I tried is that he's going to be back to his old gangster ways. So, okay.
Yeah.
I know we talked about a lot of scenes, but are there any scenes or moments from the film that we haven't touched on that I know, Vanessa, you've seen this film too many times to leave anything on the table?
I mean, we've hit all of my favorite moments, I think, from the Finucci brothers playing the piano to the disarming Germany line. I don't think we've missed anything. It's all pretty hilarious. I love the bags. It's hard to figure out while you're watching this movie, who has what bag, because there's three bags, one with cash, one with money, and one with lingerie. And it's hard to figure out who has what bag at one time. So maybe that's another reason why I like watching this movie over and over again, is to try to pinpoint where the bag is. Because if you're not paying close attention, you can really miss it. So, you know, anytime that the bags are revealed to me, I'm like, oh, okay, got it. Now I'm up to date with the bag. So, I mean, I find it all very funny. I don't know what's wrong with me. I'm just not up to stuff when it comes to being a critic, I guess.
All right.
I love that the gangster men are excellent bakers and chefs.
Mm.
Like they have this knowledge of, I mean, this guy is just kneading some good looking dough there. Like he knows what he's doing. There's no recipe. There's no flour anywhere. He's still pristine. They're calling for parsley, and
that's the one thing that I've learned about all the mob movies is that for some reason they're all excellent cooks.
That's a thing.
There's a thing in The Godfather where they talk about how to make tomato sauce. There's a thing in Goodfellas where even when in prison, they take a little razor blade and they're slicing up the garlic nice and thin so it melts. They're like, yeah, apparently
is that playing upon the Italian stereotype?
Maybe just a bit. Okay.
I mean, smoking a salmon, I don't know how Italian that is, but he knew how to do it.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. Okay. So a couple of pieces of trivia real quick, just kind of one major one. And that's, I always like to go down the alternative casting road. So this movie was something John Landis wanted to do for a very long time. He actually originally pitched this movie in the early 80s, and he wanted to cast John Belushi in the role of Snaps. Mm-hmm. After their success together in the Blues Brothers, but ultimately that didn't come to fruition. That seems like an odd casting choice.
But Stallone makes sense.
I mean, look, they at least get the nationality correct with that, because I mean, you know, but Belushi obviously would be a different, way different comedic energy than Stallone.
Don't see him running up and down the stairs.
No, although he'd probably like fall down the stairs at least a few times. He'd like at one point he'd trip and fall down. That is the one thing I would have loved to see at some point, if I could, you know, to have like Snaps at some point become a little bit more unraveled, like, and have him like fall down stuff. But you know, Stallone's not doing that. Mm-mm. He's like, I'm gonna look good.
He's taking enough beating from Rocky.
Right. He's like, yeah, I'm gonna look good in this entire movie from start to finish. Later on, when the project gets revived, there were two potential choices for Snaps. The first was originally my wife's favorite, Danny DeVito.
Oh, that's something.
Yeah, I don't know if now is a good time to delve into my wife's odd, very particular disdain for Danny DeVito.
We can't stand him.
We'll bring it back for a different episode. But that ends up not happening. But then the other one, who actually, according to John Landis, was his first choice once the movie was up and running, was Al Pacino.
That's who I was gonna say. That's literally who I was gonna cast if it wasn't Stallone. Actually, I could still. So a lot of times when we watch these movies and we say, "Oh, I could never see anybody else playing the role," that doesn't apply for me. I could totally see Al Pacino playing this and having it be funny, I think, and dramatic at the same time, because he's such a good actor, and I love him.
But apparently, so it was between this or Dick Tracy, and Dick Tracy paid more money. Apparently, he got $3 million to do Dick Tracy, and he got offered $2 million to do Oscar. So we ended up getting Stallone. And yeah, I like in either way, I still think it's the birth of broad Pacino that we've all come to know and have mixed feelings about. Because I think he's in this movie, like he's going to match everyone else's energy. He's going to go nuts. So maybe Stallone was the more grounded choice between him and Pacino.
We'll never know.
Okay. Enough. We'll pull away from Danny DeVito for now. But okay. So let's take this movie to the guilt meter on a scale of 1 to 5 shame spirals. 1 being you love this movie, you think everybody needs to see this movie, all the way to five, meaning you either don't like this movie, or if you like this movie, there's no one you could recommend it to in good conscience. Where does Oscar fall on the guilt meter? Vanessa, let's start with you.
Well, before you, Lou, actually, before you came into my world with, I'm going to do Oscar. And I'm like, I love this movie. And then I thought, why is this on Guilty Pleasures? It was a one for me. But having talked to you both and really seeing that Rotten Tomatoes number, I was just like, oh, I can't believe this. Now I understand a little more. I'm going to go with a two. I still think it's very, very funny. And if you take it for a campy film that probably should just be a play and just look at it that way, I think you'll really enjoy it. But you both have me feel a little bit guilty now, I gotta say.
Yeah. I'm sorry and thank you.
You're welcome.
All at the same time. That's okay. All right, fair. Donna, what do you say?
I'm gonna give it a 2.5. I would have rated it a lower, more like a lower meaning higher.
Okay. Yes.
Closer to the 5 until towards the end of the movie. And then I found myself getting wrapped up and like, oh, what's going to happen? And then I actually found myself enjoying it a bit more. Mm-hmm. It was a real slow start though. It was a real slow start.
I would say that if you could tighten up that first maybe 15, 20 minutes and it's probably got a little swifter pace. That's always the thing with I rewatched John Landis movies quite a bit recently because I rewatched Trading Places and a couple of other things. His pacing he takes his time on comedies. And I think we're probably more accustomed to a faster paced comedy these days. So you got to know that going into it. But yeah, that like that opening scene with him and Anthony is kind of slow, but I'd agree. I think the movie picks up. I actually think people should see this movie. I really think this is a hit kind of, I don't know if it's a hidden gem, but I think it's underrated. I really do. I enjoyed myself. So I think I'll give it a 2 along with you, Vanessa, because I think, first of all, if you're a Stallone fan, you should see this movie to be a completist, because it's not nearly as embarrassing as Rhinestone or Stop or My Mom Will Shoot. Like, of his comedies, it works really well. And it's so fun to see all of these like recognizable actors that we all like doing funny things and doing silly things. So is it a comedy classic? No, but it's also just, I mean, I enjoyed myself from start to finish. I thought it was a delight. So I, no shame here. I think you should all check it out. But I want to thank you both for joining us to talk about Oscars. And I know, Vanessa, you and I just got done talking about Oscars. We talked about the Best Picture nominees. Yes. Is that correct?
That is correct. And I believe people can still go listen to it. Yeah, they can. If it's Oscar Sunday, so you can go and listen to that real quick, fast forward to the parts where we're not arguing and actually giving our predictions of who's going to win what and fill out your ballots. But that was, I really enjoyed our podcast. I thought while we may not have helped the listeners completely fill out their ballots, there was some really good insight on a couple of the films, Nomadland and what's the Sound movie? I'm just calling it Sound.
Yeah.
But some of the discussion that came up in those films were just really great and had some really unique perspectives, which I love about all of our hosts on the Front Row Network.
And and Vanessa does a great job of hosting, and the benefit to you listening to it, maybe even after the fact, is now you get to laugh at us at how wrong we were about certain things and be like, oh, they were certain so-and-so was going to win and now they didn't. So, there's benefit either before or after the award. So yeah, it was a really good discussion.
Can I tell you, yes, that is the part of that podcast that makes me cringe the most, is knowing that people are still going to be able to listen to it after the awards show, because we did a post discussion about Green Book after it won. We discussed the whole Oscars ceremony, and I hadn't seen it yet. So on paper, I was like, oh yeah, I'm happy it won. It makes total sense. This story of this couple here, and they become friends. And then I saw it, and I was like, ooh, there are some things in this film that make you go, huh? So now I don't pretend to know anything about who should win Best Picture. I'm just reading what the critics are saying at this point. So there you go.
Excellent. And what's going on with Beyond the Mouse for May?
Oh, Beyond the Mouse. We have some really great interviews coming up. But for actual shows, let's see. I think we have, well, here's fun. Here's one that really should have been on Guilty Pleasures is Planes, Fire, and Rescue. It's part of the Cars universe. We thought it was going to be a very Guilty Pleasure movie. It's actually really good. So we have a friend of the podcast, Alexis, come on, and she talks about this sequel. It's a sequel as well. So who would have thought that a sequel would be so good? It really kind of beats out other Cars movies. It's about planes, but that one's really good. We have some great guests coming up on podcasts. We get to hear Brett talk about how much he loves or maybe hates the movie Tomorrowland. So lots of fun over on Beyond the Mouse. And you can also check out our Facebook group if you want to get involved with having some of that fun. Beyond the Mouse Podcast Pals. We put up polls. We have discussions. Right now, we're having everybody post their favorite song. So it's a lot of fun if you want to check us out.
Excellent. And you guys are way better on the Facebook game than I am, because Guilty Pleasures does have a Facebook page and I'm really bad at updating it. I need to get away from the page and onto the group, because I think Facebook groups are where it's at. Maybe as you're listening to this, I'm tinkering around to start up a Guilty Pleasures group where we can get get people talking about stuff like that. But you can find me on Twitter at the fake Lou Hair. You can find Guilty Pleasures on Facebook and wherever you get your podcasts. And please make sure wherever you're listening to us that you subscribe. If you're on Apple Podcasts, please leave us a review. If you leave a 5-star review and you recommend a film in your review, we'll do it. We've got some fun ideas coming up, but we're always willing to switch things up. I know one thing that we're definitely going to be doing for the month of May. It's Mother's Day. And so we're going to be talking about Mommy Dearest, turning 40. And I don't know how I feel about going back and watching this movie, but I know it's a Guilty Pleasures staple. So we've held off long enough. So we're going to save that for our Mother's Day special. And then we'll see what else we want to do for the month of May. So if there's something you want to find, want us to talk about, please make sure you get us wherever you get your podcasts. Also, I want to give a shout out to our international listeners. We've actually seen an uptick in some international listeners in the past few weeks. So I want to thank you. I want to welcome you. And I hope you're enjoying this wherever you're listening. And find me on Twitter. Let me know what's going on. But I appreciate people finding us and sharing us and listening. So thank you both for joining us. We know we've got a whole bunch of stuff coming up on the Front Row and on Guilty Pleasures. So make sure you're dialed into the Front Row Network on Facebook as well and on NPR Illinois, so you can see all of our shows, everything that's going on. And now that Oscar season is done, we'll be talking about maybe summer movie season. So lots of cool stuff coming up. But in the meantime, I hope you're all doing well. I hope you are enjoying your Oscar Sunday. And until next time, for the Front Row and for Guilty Pleasures, I'm Lou Hare.
I'm Donna Hare.
And I'm Vanessa Ferguson.
And as always, we'll see you in the Front Row.